It passed Scott Fisher's body. Later, we found Rob Hall. We kept climbing. By 11 the next morning, we reached the top. In years to come, I knew. The lessons of the tragedy on Everest would be all but forgotten. Climbers would take the same risks, make the same mistakes, and some of them would die, as climbers have been doing for more than 9 decades. But smelling the earth and the fragrant trees above Tengboche Monastery, days after our summit, I realized in the deepest sense my own good fortune. I had survived Everest once more. I wondered if I would be wise enough to stay away. Chapter 7. Chomolungma has lit a light within me. On the night of May 20th, the team finally received confirmation from meteorologist Martin Harris in England that the jet stream had moved to the north. A window of good weather was opening. David Brashears described the summit plan. In the early morning of May 23rd, around midnight of the 22nd, we will leave the South Col and head up. 4 Sherpas will assist with the camera. 2 Sherpas will carry oxygen for the others, and 2 will cache additional bottles on the southeast ridge for the returning climbers. No Sherpa will carry more than 35 pounds. If all went according to plan, the summit team of 11 climbers and Sherpas would be on top by 10 or 11 a.m. and back on the South Col between 2 and 4 in the afternoon, giving them a safety margin of a few hours before darkness set in. "Keep your fingers crossed and say your mantras," David advised. "Now we only need that good weather." To the call. The team then attended to important details such as taping insulating foam to the handles of their ice axes. Gripping steel in minus 30-degree temperatures would conduct the cold right into their hands, increasing the risk of frostbite. On May 21st, the team set out for Camp 3. When they arrived that afternoon, they crawled into the tents perched on the snow shelves they had dug into the Lhotse face. Over the past few weeks, they had climbed to Camp 3 and descended to base camp 4 times. The next morning, they continued upward. At the Yellow Band, known to geologists as the Chomolungma Detachment, the world's highest fault, Ed reminded himself to stop on the way down to collect rock samples for geologist Kip Hodges. The team then crossed the Geneva Spur, and in early afternoon reached Camp 4 on the South Col at 26,000 feet. Araceli was awed by Everest's proximity. "When I stepped onto the col, I could hear the mountain murmur. It came out in full display, black, white, red, orange, and gold, a magnificent pyramid of rock and ice. The wind had created a different landscape. The spent oxygen bottles, twisted aluminum, and shredded nylon of abandoned tents made the col look like a field of metallic snowflowers." The team's storage tent was still standing, despite the high-tech material used in their construction. Tents are often destroyed by the col's ferocious winds. Yasuko Namba's body was 400 yards away, but 2 other bodies lay in the open nearby, though no one paid them much attention. Dealing with one's own life here at the lower edge of the death zone was more urgent. David decided that one member of the team should remain on the South Col as a communications and safety officer. With regret, he selected Sumio Tsuzuki, whose cracked ribs would have endangered her summit attempt. "I was disappointed, but knew that my role in supporting the team on the South Col was important for assuring their safe return," she said later. After setting up camp, the climbers dried out their clothes, mittens, and inner boots, which had become wet from perspiration. By 5 p.m. on May 22nd, they had finished melting snow and ice for their water bottles and had gagged down a few bites of food. Hanging out in the death zone. Doctors and Himalayan climbers recognize the death zone as a general term, but the dangerous effects of extreme altitudes on the body and mind are difficult to overstate. Above 26,000 feet, climbers generally don't want to eat, drink, put their boots on, or go outside. Even the smallest amount of physical exertion requires an arduous effort. The body deteriorates rapidly at this altitude, sleep is barely possible and not restorative, and food is poorly absorbed. Humans cannot survive for extended periods above this height. Araceli put on her oxygen mask and fell asleep immediately, Ed laughed. I lay there for 4 hours remembering how hard it was to climb Everest without oxygen. Had I trained enough? Was I still mentally strong enough? I didn't want to let anyone down, including myself, and was anxious to get moving. David and Robert had to work that night. Confined with their cooking gear and the film equipment in a 3-man tent, Robert had to load 4 large IMAX film magazines, while David checked the camera lenses in body. Operations that were complicated by their cumbersome oxygen masks, which they frequently removed. Without bottled oxygen, however, they could function for only 15 minutes before their muscle reactions and movements slowed down. At base camp, Paula was nervous. I still have dreams and fears about Ed climbing. I've trained myself to be positive, and I practice envisioning Ed and the rest of the team standing on the summit and getting down safely. Each climb is a new situation, a new mountain, and I believe in our team's ability to make the right choices. Paula, Liz, Brad, and Wong Chu decided to get some sleep. But it was a restless night. The climb. At 9 p.m. on May 22nd, Ed arose, melted more snow for water, and forced down a Pop-Tart, the last solid food he would consume for 48 hours. Knowing that he wouldn't eat on the mountain, he added some energy drink to 2 liters of water and placed the bottles in his pack. It can take 7 liters of water a day to remain fully hydrated at high altitudes, but climbers can't carry that much. Despite their dehydration, they experience little thirst and are too cold to think about drinking the half-frozen slush in their water bottles. I woke Araceli, called Paula on the radio, climbed out of the tent, and told David that I'd see him soon. Ed recalled. He left an hour before the others at 11 p.m. Climbing without oxygen and breaking trail, he expected that the rest of the team would catch up with him. The sky was black. Ed tried to remember from his reconnaissance the day before how to skirt the crevasses of the steep ice bulge above Camp 4. Probably by sheer luck, I hit the fixed rope at the bottom of the triangular face right on, he said. The rope led 800 feet up a snow gully, at a 30 to 40 degree angle, then onto a snow slope at 50 degrees. It was slightly windy, typical for early morning on the mountain. Paula's words over the radio echoed in Ed's thoughts. Climb that mountain like you've never climbed it before. He climbed methodically, kicking through the fresh snow. He looked back occasionally for the headlamps of the rest of the team. His breathing was rapid. Step, pant, step, pant. Each laborious step took 5 seconds, a pace that slowed as he gained altitude. Though the walking distance from the South Col to the summit is only 1.5 miles, the climbers can cover the terrain at an average of only 12 feet per minute. By now, David and Robert had broken ice into a pan and brewed up. They put on their overboots and placed water containers and 2 oxygen bottles in their packs, along with still cameras, spare mittens, spare goggles, and a couple of candy bars. They checked the pressure on the oxygen bottles to make sure they were full and rechecked the regulators to confirm that the oxygen was flowing at a rate of 2 liters per minute. They clipped on their crampons and had a sip of tea before leaving. At midnight, they joined John Ling and Araceli outside. While we lay in our tents, she didn't stop puffing, Araceli wrote of the wind high on the mountain. But before we left the call, she became quiet, as if consenting to our climb. The 4 went off into the darkness, their visible world defined by the reach of their headlamps. Deep breathing and the crunching of crampons on the ice were the only sounds. Jomling felt the coolness of his mother's ivory rosary around his wrist. He chanted mantras while counting off the beads between his thumb and the crook of his forefinger. The Sherpas also were ready to depart the call, and they radioed base camp to check in. A Sherpa at base camp lit a juniper incense fire at the Lapso. He would keep it burning until the entire team returned to Camp 4. To the Southeast Ridge. Ed was making a better time than he expected. The knee-deep snow was a hassle, but it was exciting to be up there, and I resolved to plow through it. After 2 hours of climbing, the beam of his headlamp illuminated a corpse sitting upright. The face and upper body were covered with snow. It was Scott Fisher. "I found it hard to look at him," Ed recalled sadly. "I wanted to spend some time there, and decided that I would stop on the way down." In the South Gully, just below the southeast ridge, Ed realized that the rest of the team wasn't catching up, so he dug a hole in the snow, sat down, and waited. Without bottled oxygen, he quickly became cold, and after waiting for 45 minutes, he decided to move on. He waited again on the balcony at 27,600 feet, the first landmark of the southeast ridge. He was exhilarated to be so high on the mountain, witnessing the first glimmer on the horizon grow brighter and bathe the world in amber light. The rest of the team plodded upward. "On summit day, I'm in a cocoon," David said, describing the final push. "I get into a mantra of rhythm, and every bit of focus and ambition goes into putting one foot in front of the other. I feel reduced to elemental thoughts, to a state of consciousness that emanates from the need to survive. It's not a creative mode. I become pragmatic and methodical, and monitor my body's functions and resources. With every step, I'm thinking about my pace, my breathing, my posture, the time frame for reaching the southeast ridge, and the weather. Wondering whether, once we reach the south summit, we will still be a group, with Robert and the camera somewhere nearby." To stay warm, Ed had to keep climbing, and he continued to push through knee and thigh deep snow. David, Robert, Araceli, and John Ling waited at the balcony for the IMAX camera and were joined by Jesus Martinez of Spain, Yuron Krop of Sweden, and two Sherpas. Thierry Renault of France, climbing on the South African's permit, was ahead of them. As we waited and watched the sunrise, I turned off my oxygen, but took a few lungfuls every 10 minutes to stay warm and active, Robert said. Araceli was excited. "I felt euphoric when we reached the southeast ridge, partly because I was sharing that beautiful day with the people on our team. We had a good attitude and knew we were finally on our way to the top." John Ling sat and observed the tiny flat spot below the balcony, his father's and Sir Edmund Hillary's last camp before the summit. He remembered the story of his father's night there on the snow shelf, barely large enough for a small tent. John Ling then gazed out over Khumbu, placid in the morning haze far below them. He felt he could hear the ritual chanting of monks, their pulse-like drum beats and high-pitched horns. When Jungbu arrived at the balcony with the camera, David and Robert set up a shot. They promptly realized they had lost their voices, not uncommon at altitude, from deeply breathing the dry, cold air through an oxygen mask, which dries the air even more. They communicated with each other in sign language. From the balcony, the team started on the 1,100 vertical foot ascent to the south summit. By the time they reached it, they had been moving continuously for 9 hours. The South Summit. At 9 a.m., a voice croaked over the radio, Liz Cohen reported, who was at base camp, and we all jumped out of our seats. David and Ed were at the south summit, and the rest of the team trailed behind by at least 1 hour. The two waited there for some minutes before they became cold, then continued on. At that altitude, the simple act of breathing requires so much metabolic energy that it is not possible to stay warm for more than a short time, regardless of clothing. Just beyond the south summit, David and Ed came upon Rob Hall's body. "It was obvious that he had done all the right things," David said. He had surrounded himself with extra oxygen bottles and removed his crampons to keep his feet warm. He had applied his formidable willpower and mountaineering skill in a heroic attempt to survive. But Rob was a long way from help. Nobody could have survived in those conditions, and nobody could have saved him. "Seeing Rob Hall's body was the hardest part of the ascent," Araceli said. "And he was right at a place where we most needed to concentrate. Not a place to make a mistake." They were now only 300 vertical feet from the summit, but had yet to surmount the treacherous Hillary's step In Tiger of the Snows, Audrey recalled, Tenzing Norgay described the winding, snowy, humped ridge of the south summit and the steep, rocky step, later termed the Hillary Step. Some 40 feet high, that blocked his and Hillary's progress in 1953. Hillary discovered a vertical crack in the outcropping and was able to get into it and jam and wriggle his body upward. Tenzing followed. As David moved ahead, he could see that the route up the Hillary Step had changed and was more awkward and time-consuming than in 1983 and 1985. Also, the route was laced with a confusing and entangling maze of old, fixed ropes. Thierry Renault was ahead of David but moving slowly, spurring fears of another delay. For Araceli, everything seemed to go wrong at the Hillary Step. Her nose started to bleed and she stopped, holding up climbers behind her. Then when she placed her handkerchief inside her oxygen mask, her goggles fogged. After I finally climbed the Hillary Step, I asked John Ling how far it was to the summit, she said. Of course, he hadn't been there either, but the summit ridge seemed to go on forever. Success. At 10:55 a.m., Nepal time, May 23rd, Ed radioed base camp to say that he and David had gone as far as they could. From where we are now, it's downhill in all directions, he announced from the summit. The Sherpas heard cheers from the dining tent and came in to join Liz, Paula, Brad, and Wong Chu. Jung Bu caught up with Ed and David on top, and the three of them waited 20 minutes for the camera. Climbing Sidar Lhakpa Dorji was also moving slowly, having decided to climb without oxygen. Again, Ed was getting cold and had to get going, which meant descend. He passed Jam Ling and Araceli as they approached the top and gave them each a hug of congratulations. Around 11:35 a.m., Jam Ling, Araceli, Robert, and Sherpas Lhakpa Dorji, Thailand Dorji, and Muktu Lhakpa reached the top. Araceli took out the Catalan flag while Jam Ling and David took photographs of her. Over the radio, she was connected to a reporter with Catalan Television, and she declared that she was hungry for more chocolate. Jam Ling may have been the most ecstatic. The moment I reached the summit, I felt a rush of excitement. This is where my father had stood 43 years ago. I hugged David and thanked him, because he had given me the opportunity to climb Chomolungma. I cried a bit out of joy, and as I looked around, I put my hands together and said, Chuchiche, thank you to Chomolungma. Then I prayed. I prayed that my father might be able to watch and be proud. And I prayed also for our safe descent. Alternately facing in the cardinal directions, Jam Ling cast small handfuls of blessed rice into the air. He then unfurled the long prayer flag and tied it to the cluster of other flags and kattas adorning the metal survey stake anchored in the summit snow by an Italian expedition. Jam Ling then struck his father's summit pose for the camera, not realizing that his stance was the reverse of that now famous image of Tenzing. He was connected by radio to his wife, Soyang, in Kathmandu, who was nearly breathless. Now, no more, she exclaimed, and reminded him to be cautious coming down. He placed the photographs of his mother, his father, and His Holiness the Dalai Lama on the summit, along with a packet of blessed relics from the High Tibetan Lamas. Next to the photographs, Jam Ling left a rattle from his daughter. When the IMAX camera arrived, David began filming. He kept his oxygen mask on almost constantly, in order to concentrate better, and shot one 90-second roll of film. Having already climbed Everest, my main goal was to get the camera on the monopod and fire it up, Robert said. When I heard the sound of the camera operating smoothly, I was thrilled, for this was an important reason we came to Everest. We accomplished something historic, and it was a wonderful moment, David said. But I was also concerned that everyone get down as safely as they got up. Jesus Martinez reached the summit around 12:35. With him was Ang Rita, who had now climbed Everest a record 10 times. Accompanying them was Thierry Renault, climbing with two Sherpas, and Yuron Krop, who was very tired. It was Krop's third attempt that season. a difficult descent. Ed was moving downhill quickly. At the south summit, I sat down with Rob and just talked. He was on his side, and his left glove was off. Hall's wife Jen had asked Ed to take photographs of Hall's body. Viewing those photos later, Ed and David saw something that Ed hadn't noticed when he took the shot. A piece of material sticking out of the snow a short distance from Hall that looked as if it could have been covering a knee or an elbow. It may have been Doug Hansen, who was assumed to be near Hall, attached to the fixed rope. Lower down, at 27,000 feet, Ed again sat down, and he asked Scott Fisher about what had happened. David, too, was affected strongly. Scott was in a very lonely place, and it was sad to see him there. In another hour, he'd have been in camp. Neither Ed nor David was able to move Hall's or Fisher's body away from the route. Rob's wife Jan and Scott's wife Jean had asked me to try to retrieve some remembrances from them, Ed recounted. Rob wore a watch, and Scott wore his wedding ring on a thong necklace. But it was too immediate and too personal for me. I couldn't disturb them. I had always thought I'd grow old with them, and assumed that if they got in a situation like this one, they'd come through it alive. I'd never had a close friend die anywhere, let alone in the mountains. And here were two good friends, dead. Their faces were covered with snow, thankfully, because I wanted to remember them as I had known them. Alive. On the descent, Araceli became lethargic and eventually sat down, unaware that her oxygen had run out above the Hillary step. It felt awful and dangerous, she said. Robert had to prod her into standing up and moving. Jom Ling was at their cache of reserve oxygen bottles at the south summit, and he put a new bottle in her pack. Wow, oxygen again. Let's go, was how I felt, Araceli said. Jom Ling and I sped, vroom, down the mountain. When we arrived at the South Col, 3 hours later, Jom Ling told me he had set the regulator at 3 liters per minute flow. I said, what? So that's why we were going so fast. The South Col no longer seemed a cold and lifeless place, and I was happy to arrive there, Araceli wrote in her journal. The wind had stopped, and I turned and looked at the upper mountain. She stood elegant and powerful, an air of kindness surrounded her. Or maybe it was my own sense of peacefulness at having stepped safely onto her icy skin. Araceli and Sumio hugged, and Sumio gave her tea. The team then collapsed in sleep. David was relieved. For me, the day wasn't joyful until the moment all of us were on the South Col and in our sleeping bags. We were rewarded for our patience and perseverance and were graced with 2 days of fine weather. It's been a hard expedition for me. Standing on top was an anxious moment because of those we know who stood there less than 2 weeks before us but didn't make it down. I'm ready to go home and relax. Ed did a great job breaking trail, Robert said. And it's amazing that he did it without oxygen. All night we saw only a tiny white spot moving well ahead of us. That was Ed. He smiled with satisfaction. We formed a nice community and had good relationships all around, like brothers and sisters, even though those don't always work, he said, laughing. That night I would have liked to enter the minds and dreams of everyone there, Araceli wrote later. The Sherpas giving thanks to the divinities that protected them. Ed, thinking of Paula. Probably that night they would both sleep. David and Robert reviewing each of the decisions and steps they made, and finally feeling happy, congratulating each other. Jom Ling traveling the path of his childhood memories, warm from the summit dream that the gods had granted him, and Sumio navigating the sadness of returning home without achieving her dream, but with her strong soul planning her next summit. The team was grateful for Sumio's support, and she was happy that they had returned safely. Now I look forward to getting away from the small tent and narrow sleeping bag, and to having a hot bath and fresh bedsheets. That is my wish. All of them shared excruciating memories of their friends, so recently alive. This experience might now provide me with a signpost that says, "Maybe you'll be smart enough to stay away from the mountain for the rest of your life," David remarked. though his eyes retained its customary twinkle. The highest weather station. The next morning the south call was clear. Araceli slept soundly, and Ed had to shake her to awaken her. The team managed to fight their exhaustion and hypoxia to break camp, then assembled the GPS device and weather station. In slow motion, they hauled the instruments over to a fairly remote site. They plugged the six sensors into the recording system and used camera tripods to support the anemometer, which indicates wind speed and direction. A separate tripod held the temperature sensors and telemetry antenna. The team deployed the solar panels and then anchored all the parts with rocks. Then they set up the GPS device, pointed it properly, activated it, and took measurements. The data from the GPS would be used to determine changes in the position and elevation of the South Col since a year earlier, when measurements had last been taken. From this data, Roger Billam would later calculate that the South Col is rising at 4 millimeters per year and moving toward India at 18 millimeters per year. In 1996, Roger said that he hoped the weather station they installed would tell us about the weather high on the mountain and, with proper evaluation, make the mountain somewhat safer for climbers. Ever since, weather stations in the region have indeed provided new data on the unusual monsoon alpine desert setting of Mount Everest. In 2011, the Italian FK2CNR Pyramid Network installed a weather station on the South Col, making it the highest weather station in Khumbu. This station takes hourly measurements of temperature, humidity, atmospheric pressure, wind speed, and direction, global radiation, and precipitation. Although a weather station could be placed on the summit, it is difficult to secure everything to the very top of Mount Everest because the ice that builds up in the winter is ablated and blown away in the summer. Also, mountaineers hope they are achieving something at the edge of human limitations when they reach the summit, Roger added. It could be disappointing to find a weather station there. Return to base camp. Jomling wasn't able to help with the weather station. When he returned to the South Col from the summit, he had napped briefly, then awoke to realize that he was snowblind. Snow blindness, caused by too much ultraviolet light from the sun, usually exaggerated by reflection from the snow, results in conjunctivitis-like irritation of the cornea. During the climb, Jomling's oxygen mask had fogged his snow goggles, and for much of the climb he hadn't used them. That was the most frightening moment of the climb for me. How could I go down? I tried eye drops, and Sumio helped, but I had to break camp and stuff my pack with my eyes closed. By morning, Jomling could open his eyes for a few seconds, but they quickly teared up. Climbing Sidar, Lhakpa Dorji helped him toward camp too. On the Lhotse face, I'd steal a glance for anything dangerous above me, then look down at the route and plunge ahead with my eyes closed. I prayed and thought of my father. He improved at camp too, Jomling mentioned the pain only in passing, though snow blindness is acutely painful. Returning to base camp was a celebration for me, Araceli said. Some drank beer, but I'd been dreaming about Coca-Cola. I ate so much chocolate that I was too full to eat dinner. Alone in my tent, I thought about all we had done, and I cried, happy that we were safe. The day the team left base camp, May 29th, the Sherpas and climbers gathered at the Lhotse and again stoked the juniper incense fires. Along with the team members, they gave thanks to the gods for granting them safe passage and prayed that they be granted an opportunity to return. They then lowered the Tarchok prayer flag pole while a former monk read a prayer. Base camp had become uncharacteristically quiet. But another tragedy was about to occur. That day, after the very late hour of 5 p.m., Bruce Herod, a British climber with the South African team, radioed from the summit. He was never heard from again. Herod's was the 11th Everest death of the season. Brett Oland was outraged. How could the South Africans not have learned from what had happened just a few days earlier? I'm angry that they allowed a climber to summit so late and let another person die. The surviving members of the South African team passed through base camp on their way down. There were a few nods and hellos, but those still at base camp found it difficult to congratulate the South African team members who had returned. A hero's welcome. Araceli! Araceli! Chanted an enthusiastic crowd as Araceli Segarra, the first Spanish woman to reach the top of Mount Everest, arrived at El Prat Airport in Barcelona on June 9th. Besieged with attention, she was received by the president of Catalonia, Jordi Pujol. I was delivered fan letters addressed simply, Araceli, Alpinist of Everest, Spain. Looking as though she had stepped from a health club, she joked. I got more rest at base camp where I could sleep without the phone ringing all the time. I lost my voice telling and retelling the story of the expedition, although some reporters wanted to hear only of the deaths. It was a relief that people in Spain weren't as aware of the May 10th tragedy as in the U.S. When something safe and successful happens, nobody cares. But I try to convey the good sides to our story. A parade in Darjeeling. A third of the way around the world from Spain, Jomling also received a hero's welcome. In Kathmandu, he said, Geshe Rinpoche and Chachrul Rinpoche gave me a rare collection of sacred objects to keep on my altar, which will continue to bless me and my family. From there, Jomling left for India, and several hundred relatives and friends greeted him at the border between Nepal and West Bengal. They draped katas around his neck and fed him tea and biscuits. Signs were plastered across the front of several cars welcoming him home. The winding streets of Darjeeling, about an hour away, were graced with banners. Jomling was paraded through the hillside town to his family home, where a crowd of Sherpas bearing katas greeted him at the threshold. They also presented him with welcoming chema, rice and sampa held in a divided ceremonial tray. He took pinches of each and flicked them into the air, as is done at wedding receptions. Beer and chang flowed. They made me finish an entire bottle of beer before I could enter my own house. A warm welcome evolved quickly into a great party. The Darjeeling Sherpas were proud of me, and proud that I had advanced my father's name. But mostly I had made them proud of themselves. They were glad that I had been successful on Everest and in America, yet had decided to return to them, to my roots. Jomling went straight to the altar in the chapel room. His father's Tanka scroll painting of the goddess Miolang Sangma rests prominently on the altar, and he did three prostrations, a way of concluding the prayer for good luck and safe travels that he had recited when he departed the house. I believe that the success and overall safety of our expedition can be partly attributed to the prayers, pujas, lighting of butter lamps, and audiences with lamas, he said thoughtfully. I feel more devout than I did before the climb. Chomolungma has lit a light within me. He admitted that his high-altitude mountaineering goals were now largely satisfied. He had climbed the mountain for himself and to pay homage to his father, and would now remain at home with his wife and child in Darjeeling, running the trekking and climbing business started by his father. Following his Everest expedition, Jomling joined 350,000 other devout Buddhists in Salugara, West Bengal, for a Kala Chakra, Wheel of Life, initiation presided over by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who personally blessed him, Soyang, and his daughter. Jomling was in Darjeeling during the fall of 1996 when he heard that Lobsang Jangbu, Scott Fisher's climbing sitar, had died in an avalanche that swept three climbers from the Lhotse face. Lobsang always sought Geshe Rinpoche's blessing before he climbed, but Rinpoche passed away in July, shortly after our spring climb, so Lobsang climbed on Everest in the fall season without Rinpoche's benediction. He was killed on that climb. In Kathmandu, Elizabeth Hawley, the renowned Everest statistician, informed Robert Schauer that his 1996 climb, when compared with his ascent 18 years earlier, marked the longest interval between any individual's two Everest summits. For a period of time while the team was on the mountain, Robert's family and office staff in his Austrian hometown of Graz had been in a panic. The headline of an Austrian paper had just reported Styrian climber lost on Everest. The article referred to an unnamed mountaineer lost in a tent at 27,000 feet on Everest. As it turned out, an Austrian from Robert's home province of Styria had died on the north side of the mountain, but the climber's identity was not confirmed for almost 2 days. When he departed Austria in March, Robert had told few people that he was heading for Everest. He was concerned that press accounts might raise expectations about his success and create unwanted pressure. He returned to Austria with no fanfare and enjoyed a week of private time before the press found him and coverage of his climb appeared in the media. Jurjan Krap had also accomplished something of a first. He had completed what was certainly the most self-sufficient combined approach and climb of the mountain. David remarked on the conviction, purity, and innocence of the Swede's approach. On his first solo attempt, Krap had turned around when he encountered high winds and deep snow near the south summit, agonizingly close to the top. His irrepressible enthusiasm was unaffected, and he cheerfully recognized that he would have to accept some assistance and a climbing partner for his two subsequent summit pushes. Krap said that he intended to bicycle home by a different route, through Russia. Life begins again. Shortly before Beck Weathers was evacuated from Everest on May 13th, Dr. David Schlimm, director of Kathmandu's CIWEC Travel Medicine Center, heard reports that Weathers' arms were frozen up to the elbows. But when Weathers arrived at our clinic, it was remarkable how good his overall condition was, Schlimm said. He was the guy I'd been hearing about for 2 days, first as confirmed dead, then as too ill to risk trying to rescue. And then 24 hours later, he walked into my clinic unassisted. Mukulu Gao was in the main examination room downstairs, unable to walk because of his frostbitten feet. So Schlimm settled Beck into the exam room upstairs. First, Beck wanted to call his wife. Schlimm dialed the phone for him, and Beck chatted warmly with a very happy and relieved Peach Weathers. Most impressive was Beck's charm, concern for others, and lack of concern for the media, Schlimm said. Initially, he refused interviews, stressing that the real story was the guys who walked him off the South Col and Lhotse Face. Todd, Peter, Ed, Robert, and David. But a month after Beck returned to Dallas, it became evident that no function would return to his hands. Surgeons there performed state-of-the-art microvascular surgery to save as much of his arms as possible, and he was given skin grafts. Nevertheless, his right arm was dead to his watchband, the one he couldn't gnaw off his arm, necessitating that the arm be amputated at mid-forearm. The fingers of his left hand were dead to the knuckles, including the thumb. Surgeons cut the web of skin between the stump of his thumb and the rest of his hand, giving him limited opposition. He can lay the thumb sideways against his hand and perform tasks such as picking up a piece of paper. Beck's nose was also destroyed by frostbite. Using cartilage from his ears, some skin, and a piece of rib, doctors rebuilt his nose upside down on his forehead. Once the blood supply was established, they rotated it into position. In place of his right hand, Beck wears a microelectric prosthetic device that reads electrical currents from the muscles of his forearm to open and close a claw, allowing him to pour a cup of coffee and pick it up. "When I first wanted to make this trip," he joked, "I looked at the outrageous cost and said, you know, this thing is going to cost me an arm and a leg." Well, as you can see, I bargained them down. "Once you've been dead, everything looks pretty good for a while," Weathers said softly. "But it doesn't get much better than coming home to your family. The price that I paid is one thing, but the price my family paid is another. I was able to come back and tell them everything I hadn't been able to before, about how much they mean to me." "Beck has an incredible will," David said in amazement. "He knew he would lose most of his hands, but he just decided that he wanted to live. He's our one miracle, the one great inspirational story out of all the tragedy, along with the selfless heroes among the climbers, Sherpas, base camp staff, and the helicopter pilot who gave their all to the rescue." A heroic pilot. As head of his Royal Nepalese Army Squadron of Helicopter Pilots, Lieutenant Colonel Mudden Casey felt that if anyone should try a rescue at Camp 1, he should. Although most of his flying missions in Nepal are rescues, Casey said that few survivors have thanked the pilots, and none have written letters. Peach Weathers was an exception, and the letters she wrote poignantly thanking Casey for giving her husband back to her helped forge a lasting bond between their families. In early 1997, Casey was invited to the annual meeting of the Helicopter Association International in Southern California. Beck and Peach Weathers were also invited. When they arrived at the airport in Anaheim, a helicopter identical to the one that rescued Beck was waiting to shuttle him from the airport to the convention center. At the banquet, he saw Mudd and Casey for the first time since he had stepped from his helicopter, and they were both near tears. Mudden was awarded the Robert E. Trimble Memorial Award for distinguished service, and he received a standing ovation. Mudden wasn't acting out of a desire for glory, Beck said. Until the helicopter sat down in Kathmandu, neither of us had any idea that anyone would be the least bit interested in the story. In April 1997, another function was held at the Smithsonian Institution's National Air and Space Museum, and Beck was selected to present Mudden the Aviation Week and Space Technology Laureate Award. In Kathmandu, KC was also awarded Nepal's highest honor, the Star of Nepal Medal, presented by His Majesty the King. It was not really bravery, the charismatic KC said with humility. It was in the line of duty. Through hard work, good judgment, and a fair amount of luck, we prevailed, Brad Oland reflected, but now without a stiff reminder of the delicate place man occupies in nature. As for my own involvement, though I never went above base camp, I felt privileged, challenged, and humbled. Filmmaker Greg McGillivray was upbeat. We are all proud of the team and of their determination, courage, skill, and good judgment. Not only did they reach the summit, they had the patience to do it safely. Life in the mountains draws out the character of those that journey there, Dr. Jim Litch said. Maybe this is one of the many reasons why we climb. To see ourselves at the core, not packaged and contained as we are when living within the constraints of technology and consumerism. Mountains are hazardous and there will be deaths, Dr. Tom Hornbein concluded. And as the crowding increases, it's like setting up more pins at the end of the bowling alley. There are more to knock down. Beck Weathers is sorry that he went to Everest. And he quietly admits, as if ashamed of his former ignorance, that what he was searching for was with him all along. Home, health, family, and friends. But like others who have touched Everest's icy skin, he may have come away with something found nowhere else. One lure of Everest is that the decisions you make there are real and difficult, and you have to live with them, he reflected. His eyes gleamed, almost as if the spirit of Choma Lungma were drawing him back. No doubt there will continue to be more good men and women willing to gamble and lose for the privilege of being in one of the world's most rare, beautiful places. In depth, Ed Viesters, HVR, and VO2 Max. Ed has a rare ability to operate exceedingly well at high elevations, said David Bashirs, a powerful climber himself. Ed chose his parents well, explained Dr. Robert Brownie Shaney, a pulmonary critical care physician and expert on high altitude medicine. Much of his ability is due to his genetics. But anyone who has climbed with Ed will tell you that he simply moves well. He's smart and careful, but bold enough to do great climbs. Since the late 1970s, Dr. Shaney, an accomplished mountaineer, has studied the performance capabilities of endurance athletes and high-altitude climbers, and was a member of the 1981 American Medical Research Expedition on Everest. Before Ed departed Seattle for the Everest film expedition, Shaney tested him at the University of Washington's Pulmonary Function and Exercise Laboratory. Predictably, Ed scored high on every test. To determine his response to hypoxia, Ed relaxed as he breathed into a mouthpiece that measured the quantity of air he exhaled. Over 10 minutes, the amount of oxygen supplied to him was decreased, causing hypoxemia or a low level of oxygen in the bloodstream, which in turn stimulated his breathing. Ed's hypoxic ventilatory response, or HVR, ranked high, meaning that the volume of air he breathed increased substantially as the oxygen supply was decreased. At moderate altitudes of 10,000 to 14,000 feet, where the available oxygen is only 60 to 70% that of sea level, a brisk HVR minimizes the susceptibility to some high-altitude illnesses and may improve performance, Shaney said. But above 20,000 feet, where there is very little excess oxygen, adequate breathing is essential to ensure that enough oxygen gets from the lungs to the blood and into the tissues. On the summit of Everest, about 30% of a climber's oxygen intake goes to the physical activity of breathing. This means that 30% of the climber's energy is spent simply on survival, Shaney said. At sea level, a normal person at an exhaustive level of exercise spends only 7% of his energy on breathing. Aerobic capacity, or VO2 max by comparison, is the maximum volume of oxygen an individual can absorb at the end of exhaustive exercise, and is a marker of aerobic fitness. Shaney and others have determined that low-altitude endurance athletes have a high VO2 max. Ed's VO2 max tested very high. People then assumed that elite extreme altitude climbers must also have huge VO2 max levels because as one ascends, the ease of oxygen consumption falls, Shaney pointed out. But some climbers defy this, particularly Reinhold Messner, the first person to summit Everest without supplementary oxygen. Messner's VO2 max is higher than the norm, but is not exceptional. The relationship between VO2 max and climbing ability is somewhat of a mystery. Other factors also enable Ed and other successful extreme altitude climbers to move well in the mountains, such as an efficient biomechanical makeup. But following the tragic deaths of May 1996, many people have brought up the idea of testing climbers, especially guided clients, before recommending they climb Everest. Should Everest be guided? In 1985, David Brashears accompanied Dick Bass, 55, up Everest, the first guided summit. Since then, several Everest clients have cited Bass's success as their inspiration. Brashears, however, points out that Bass was not average. He carried his own loads and climbed without ropes, where even some experienced climbers have difficulty. Dick is very independent-minded. He's a powerhouse, a force of nature, Brashears says, respectfully. But for others, he adds, reaching the top is like stepping up to the plate in the ninth inning of the World Series and hitting the ball out of the park, without having trained season after season to acquire the skills needed to get there in the first place. The ability to pay the $65,000 fee doesn't make you more experienced, Robert Schauer concurs, expressing a legitimate apprehension about novice clients. But clients come in every variety, from unseasoned trophy seekers to experienced Himalayan mountaineers, looking for an outfitter and a permit. It should also be remembered that three of the five climbers who died on the south side of the mountain, on or shortly after May 10th, were experienced guides. These deaths did not result from the actions of clients, says client Lou Kosciuszki, who turned around just below the south summit. Kosciuszki points out that if everything is going right, Everest is very climbable. But if anything goes wrong and mistakes can be made easily and quickly by even the best, people will die. It is virtually impossible for guides to save anyone above the South Col. After Camp 4, the time for coaching from the guides is over. And guides are not paid to take risks. They are paid for the judgment of what risks are worth taking. Indeed, in the mountains, a climber's judgment and attitude are critical. Three of Rob Hall's clients, acting on their own judgment, avoided a life-threatening situation when they decided to turn around. Sometimes climbers will put every bit of their physical and psychological energy into reaching the summit, leaving it to the guides and others to get them down, Pete Athens says. Athens points out that the clients pay him to make his best decisions, but that sometimes means denying them the summit. His associate Todd Burleson concurs, I feel it's better to have everyone come home safe but disappointed than to have one person die. This kind of decision-making, in fact, is what most clients are looking for. Climbing is no longer only a sport. It has become a business, and for some, their only income, concluded Charles Houston. The more ventured, the more gained. He suggested that this gamble might explain the risks that some guides and clients, possibly for different reasons, and against high odds of weather and terrain, are willing to take on a dangerous mountain such as Everest. I consider myself a cautious mountaineer, David Brashear says. I don't like to take unnecessary risks, and because of that, I might live longer. You can't forsake yourself or others for the summit of a mountain. Flash forward. Ed Viesters. In 2002, Viesters was awarded the Lowell Thomas Award for his achievements in mountaineering. In 2005, he completed his 18-year Endeavor 8000 project by climbing Annapurna, making him one of the few people and the only American to have summited the world's 14 8,000-meter peaks, and the sixth person to have done so without supplemental oxygen. Named National Geographic's Adventurer of the Year that year, Viesters went on to write several books about his climbing adventures, including The Mountain, My Time on Everest. David Brashears. Brashears returned to Everest in 1997 to shoot a documentary for PBS, and again in 2004 for his documentary Storm Over Everest, in which survivors of the 1996 disaster reflect on their experiences. He has written several books, and more recently founded Glacier Works, a non-profit organization that uses cutting-edge technology to create unprecedented megapixel images of the Himalaya and exhibits them internationally to raise awareness about climate change in the region. He has spent several years advising and co-producing Universal Pictures' 2015 Everest movie, which retells the story of 1996. Araceli Segarra. Since 1996, Segarra has worked as a motivational speaker, a model, and a children's book author. She has also continued climbing, scrambling over mountains. She has gone on some 30 expeditions, several of which opened new routes, and worked on several films in the mountains, including 7 Years in Tibet. In 2013, she wrote Not So High, Not So Difficult, a book to help readers achieve their goals, using climbing as a metaphor for life and including her reflections on the 1996 Everest season. Jomling Tenzing Norgay. In 2001, Norgay wrote a memoir called Touching My Father's Soul about his experience climbing Everest. In 2002, he and Peter Hillary, Edmund Hillary's son, were part of an Everest expedition meant to commemorate the 50th anniversary of their father's first ascent. Norgay runs an adventure and travel company, Tenzing Norgay Adventures, which offers expeditions in and around the Himalaya. In 2012, Norgay and his siblings started the Tenzing Norgay Sherpa Foundation to help the Sherpa of the Himalaya. As a motivational speaker, he often talks about his climbing experiences. Robert Schauer. Schauer has continued to climb and to film around high mountains. In 2000, he worked as a cameraman with David Brashears on the IMAX film Kilimanjaro, To the Roof of Africa. He returned and summited Everest once again in 2004, while working on David Brashears' documentary Storm Over Everest. He is the founding director of the international film festival Mountain Film, which takes place annually in Graz, Austria. Though he officially ended his climbing career in 2006, he returned to Kilimanjaro in 2014 and climbed it a second time. John Krakauer. After returning from Everest in 1996, Krakauer wrote a narrative of the experience for Outside magazine. He then wrote Into Thin Air, a book that went on to become a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and a bestseller. He founded the Everest 96 Memorial Fund at the Boulder Community Foundation, which contributes to charities such as the American Himalayan Foundation. He has gone on to publish more nonfiction books, including Under the Banner of Heaven, 2003, and Where Men Win Glory, 2009. Michael Groom. Australian Michael Groom was 40 years old when he climbed Mukalu in 1999, completing his goal to climb the world's five highest peaks. He climbed all five without bottled oxygen, and climbed all but Kangchenjunga without the front third of his feet, which he lost to frostbite in 1987. He serves as a motivational speaker and has written a book about his climbing adventures and philosophy called Sheer Will. He plans to return to the Himalaya to attempt the southwest ridge of Amadalam. Broughton Coburn. Coburn is a writer, lecturer, and college instructor who specializes in creating narratives of the people and landscape of the Himalaya. Since 1996, he has written a young adult photobiography of Sir Edmund Hillary, Triumph on Everest, co-wrote Jomling Tenzing Norgay's autobiography, Touching My Father's Soul, and written The Vast Unknown, which explores the first American ascent of Everest in 1963. He often speaks publicly, and some of his lectures vividly recount the events and the context of the 1996 season on Everest and the IMAX film expedition. Mukluu Gao Mingho. Mukluu Gao had to have his fingers, nose, and parts of his feet amputated after spending the night in the death zone in 1996. After undergoing some 15 reconstructive surgeries, he relearned how to walk. He returned to the world of climbing in China in 1998. In 2007, he returned to Everest to lead an expedition up the north side of the mountain for the Taiwan Mountaineering Association. He gives an in-depth account of his harrowing night on Everest in David Brashear's documentary film, Storm Over Everest. Seaborn Beck Weathers. Weathers returned home in 1996 and worked hard to recover from his extensive injuries, which required 10 surgeries. He spoke about his experience in David Brashear's documentary film Storm Over Everest. In 2010, he published a book about his experiences during the Everest disaster and his recovery called Left for Dead, My Journey Home from Everest. With the help of an assistant, Weathers still practices medicine in Texas and gives motivational speeches. Though he no longer climbs high mountains, he has become a licensed pilot. Lou Kosciuszko. Kosciuszko has retired from the world of law and business and lives with his wife on the northern shore of Lake Michigan. He spoke about his experience on Everest, including his decision to turn back from the summit, in David Brashear's 2008 documentary film Storm Over Everest. In 2014, he published a book called After the Wind, 1996 Everest Tragedy, One Survivor's Story, called by a reviewer a vivid, intimate memoir. He remains active in alpine sports and other outdoor endurance challenges. Peter Athens. Athens has developed a reputation as one of the world's most experienced high-altitude mountaineers. Called Mr. Everest, he has climbed the mountain 7 times. A 1997 medal from the American Alpine Club recognized his rescue efforts on Everest in 1996. He has worked on film projects including 7 years in Tibet and went on a National Geographic expedition to Nepal's forbidden kingdom of Mustang. He's published Tales from the Top of the World, Climbing Mount Everest with Pete Athens, and Danger and Discovery in the Sky Caves of Nepal. Ang Dorje Sherpa. In 2002, Ang Dorje immigrated to the United States to join his wife, whom he met at Everest Base Camp, and began his work as a wind turbine mechanic. They now have 2 children and live in Amsterdam. Ang Dorje returns to the Himalaya every spring to visit family members in Nepal and to climb mountains as a guide with adventure consultants. He has now summited Everest 17 times and made 28 ascents of 8,000-meter peaks. He has guided climbers up not only Everest, but also Africa's Kilimanjaro and Argentina's Aconcagua. Neil Beidleman. Beidleman returned to the Himalaya in 2000 to attempt to climb Annapurna with Ed Viesters, Veka Gustafsson, and the editor-in-chief of Alpinist magazine, Michael Kennedy. They were forced to give up the attempt due to avalanche risk. He returned and successfully summited Everest in 2011, in part to make peace with his experience there in 1996. He reflects on his 1996 experience in the documentary film Storm Over Everest. He works as an engineer and photographer in Aspen, Colorado. This concludes the reading of Everest, revised and updated edition, Mountain Without Mercy by Broughton Coburn. Compilation copyright 2015 by National Geographic Society. Text and photographs, copyright 2015 by McGillivray Freeman Films. This book was read by Mark Peckham. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with the National Geographic Society and was produced in 2015 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.